Chapter 1. One huge wave lifted the stern of the coaster, propeller and rudder out of the froth and oil just as Bill Hawken tried to swing the Tamar-class lifeboat into a better position. The bronze screw must have been about 5 feet in diameter. With no medium but air to resist, the prop picked up speed. Even above the scream of the wind and the bombardment of wave against hull, the noise of unregulated energy penetrated the darkened space of the Tamar's wheelhouse. Christ! Bill was a man rarely moved to profanity, but this was the worst sea, as coxswain, he'd ever put the crew into. Visibility was practically nil, and navigating the boat was a nightmare. He increased thrust, instinctively, on dual throttles, at the same time steering the craft in a desperate broadside away from the steel plate to the grey-painted hulk hovering above him. The boat's mechanic, Chris Pascoe, seated back from him, silently thanked the designers for saving his back as his chair cushioned the above change in pitch and rotation. It took almost the full 20 centimeters it was designed to travel, leaving its occupant free to focus on the boat management system, captured on the screen facing him. The blue fiberglass hull of the RNLI Carrick Maid hit another monstrous wave, sweeping it side-on back into the path of the descending propeller. "Look out, she's coming down!" Pascoe didn't need to voice the obvious as he braced himself against the seat's harness. In the gloom, the crew caught a glimpse of the rudder flapping, the reason the coaster had put on a mayday call in the first place. They weren't going to make it. The leading edge of the first blade to hit them scythed into the side rail at the stern of the rescue craft. They felt a shudder and the tug of metal being ripped from decking as the rail wrapped itself around the propeller, descending on them like a huge kitchen blender. The lifeboat pitched upwards and veered away from its nemesis, but stayed uncharacteristically bow high, with a distinct list to port. The upward bias wasn't normal, but the crew, conscious of the change, had more pressing responsibilities to contend with than any unease of the attitude of the boat. With the kind of instinct developed over years of navigating these coastal waters, they somehow felt the change wasn't threatening. Intuition took precedent over anxiety in a carefully selected and trained crew. Trust in the coxswain had developed, along with respect, otherwise too many shouts would have ended in disaster. Their immediate concern was Dogtooth Rock. Even in this heaving sea, the boat had picked up speed in response to Bill's earlier hand on the throttle. The rock was visible in the spray-laden gloom, as the surge of wave breaking against its seaward face gave it a luminous white apron of water. Thousands of tiny bubbles acted like a skirt of minute lenses, collecting and magnifying what little light penetrated the scene. Dogtooth had claimed a number of hits over the centuries, but this time, the granite hazard would not be shattering any hulls. The lee shore was about 100 meters or so from the Jewel being enacted by rescue boat and coaster, and Dogtooth was the only outcrop in the vicinity they needed to worry about. Bill brought the craft around, this time alongside the starboard flank of the distress vessel, at the same time keeping an eye on the demarcation between the clifftop profile and the only just lighter backdrop of sky. Another huge wave lifted them above the decking of the coaster and deposited them obliquely across its gunwale. The boat teetered, not knowing whether to slide forward onto the deck or slip back into the sea. The crew braced themselves for what seemed eternity as the rescue craft swayed and twisted on its keel. As coaster and boat together dropped into a huge trough, a peculiar lull in the motion left them in a kind of limbo. Bill had throttled down the racing screws as the rescue craft started to roll on the gunwale. He could see one of the coaster's seamen above them at the end of the side deck outside the bridge. A counterwash from the port side of the coaster hit the bow of the little boat and flushed it back towards the sea. Its keel pointed up at 40-odd degrees. The boat's radio operator looked instinctively back through the rear door to the grey turbulence they were about to plunge back into. "Bloody hell! We've got her screw embedded in our sterns." "Hell, no wonder she's riding bow high," the mechanic shouted above the screech of the keel as it scraped across the larger ship's edge. By this time, they were about 3 meters above the water. The force of re-entry could blast the rear door inwards, and they knew it. The coaster rolled on its starboard side, putting the rescue craft nearly horizontal. By this time, they were practically level with the sea, as their hull disengaged totally and refloated, a free agent. Heads and shoulders slumped in relief. arrested breathing gave way to welcome volumes of fresh oxygen. That was a pretty close one. Nearest we've been yet. Dave Lobb swiveled in his seat as he voiced the thoughts of all of them. Look, I'm going to stand off for a spell. Bill Hawken didn't need to agonize over the decision. It was an obvious choice to take. She's past the rock, and without a prop, this current and wind will take her out past Deedman's Head to open water. We can afford to wait a while for this sea to drop now, then move on to grab the crew. Any fault with that? Falmouth Coast Guard report the wind should be easing up soon. The volunteers knew there was little chance of pulling anyone off the ship, the way things were going, added to which a repeat of the previous episode risked everybody's lives on boat and ship. At least time was on their side. They still had more than 3/4 of their 4,500 litres of fuel left, and riding 70 or 80 metres back from the coaster posed no danger. I'll check out the stern damage, see if we're getting water into the refuge area, Chris Pascoe called across to Hawken. That okay? Go ahead. I'm reminding you to attach the safety cable. You need it this time, but check the refuge area first before going to the back. If the deck isn't punctured by the blade, and below is not taking any water, don't risk going out there for now. Otherwise, use some of that stop foam stuff on the underside to seal any gap between blade and deck, if it's more serious. Okay, Bill. Pascoe unbuckled his harness, removed his life jacket, and slipped out of the chair. He grabbed at a handhold as the boat took another broadside. Waiting for the next fleeting lull in the motion of the boat, he made it to the refuge hatch and went down the short stairway to the lower reaches of the hull. Everything was securely anchored one way or another, but he gave little attention to equipment that he knew would remain held by ties tested by seas worse than this. He took a torch from its cradle above one of the seats. Getting through the small doorway in the rear of the compartment was a bit of a challenge. The clumsy boots and immersion suit restricted movement. A life jacket would have been an even greater hindrance, a life-threatening danger if for some reason it became inflated below deck. Flashing the torch into a cavity just about big enough to take a couple of people, he could make out no penetration of the decking above, nor any water sloshing around his feet. Satisfied, he turned and made his way back to the cockpit. No hole, Cox, and from what I can make out, without going there, the prop is locked fair and square into the rear railing, parted from her shaft at the keyway. Okay, we've had confirmation a tug is on its way from Falmouth. They've established salvage rights with the master. We're to stay in place and give whatever assistance we can when they get here. ETA 20 to 25 minutes. Tide's on the turn, so won't drift far. It'll be light in less than an hour. Chris Pascoe put on his life jacket and buckled himself back in place as the crew settled into the more comfortable regime of a passive standoff. Able to relax some, the crew speculated about the seaworthiness of the disabled vessel, about the issuing of forged Board of Trade certificates when dodgy owners risked all for the sake of profit. This might not have been the case at this time, but the combination of a malfunctioning rudder and shaft sheared between bearing and prop bore the classic signs of an unseaworthy ship, falsely registered as seaworthy. I reckon the shaft must have been in an advanced state of fatigue for it just to lose a prop like that. Seen it before in dry dock, oxide inclusion in the shaft surface and the thing just goes from there. You can see it in the fracture. Surface smooth at the source of the break, series of crescent arcs as the break widens, then crystalline fracture when she finally goes. Jean-Pierre Pascal spoke with no trace of the tone that irritates when someone is exercising superior knowledge or training in sophistry for the sake of impressing. He was just stating facts as he perceived them. His English was pretty nigh perfect. From a Breton village near Brest, he married a girl he'd met as a boy when his parents regularly took part in twinning visits to their host village. A graduate in ship design from the École Nationale Supérieure, Brest, he'd managed to get work as a lecturer in the Faculty of Ship Design at the University of Falmouth and had proved himself a safe pair of hands on a number of hairy call-outs. Dave Lobb swiveled in his chair. The tug's just showing up, on and off the radar. Reckon it's about 1/2 mile away. Okay, tell him we've spotted him. We'll head round to the bow of the coaster. Radio its master. Ask if he's in contact with the tug and tell him his screw is embedded in our stern. Tell Falmouth Coast Guard we're moving in again and to check for any major superstructure damage. Might as well tell them too that we've got the coaster's screw stuck in our stern. Bill Hawken did a quick scan of the various functions on the screen and peered through the window into a slightly less mountainous sea. It was getting lighter. Wind was dropping. A good 50 metres from the ship's starboard side, he positioned the lifeboat mid-on at right angles. He could just make out the deck area as it tilted towards the boat. Repetitive wave sequences, like a pendulum with a period of about 5 seconds, gave him about a 2-second window of inspection each time. There were no loose rogue structures that he could see, ready to release further complications into this particular version of hell. He reversed back a few meters, headed for the bow, and traversed the port side. Satisfied there was nothing else worth noting, he peered in the direction the tug should be arriving from and positioned the rescue craft well to the stern of the disabled vessel. Back to back and separated by 100 meters of heaving water, he peered ahead, watching for the tug's lights, handing control to Andy Cornwell. The relief helmsman picked for this shout. It gave him a break and allowed him to focus better without the distraction of having continually to reposition the boat. Coming out of a trough, he caught a glimpse of a light before the 16-meter hull slid back down the next gully of water. Got her in view. Radio her. She probably picked us up on her radio near enough when we spotted her. Tell her we'll stand close until C permits a crewman to catch a line from her. I reckon we're going to wait an hour before either ship will risk putting a man on deck. Right, Cox. The crew then hunkered down, waiting for the seas to abate and for the welcome first flight to bring some respite from the eye-straining darkness. Some little while later, a new voice roused the crew from whatever each was thinking. It was one of the Coast Guard duty officers. Bill, what's the score? Coldrose is still on standby. Do you reckon you're going to need the Sea King? Don't know, way things are, we can't afford to wait. Coaster's not shipping water, so no immediate danger, and we're well clear of Dogtooth Rock. Sea's pretty bad still, but not like when we arrived. Tell him to hold. Okay, keep us in the picture. Bill swiveled round in his chair. I reckon Robin, he referred to the tug skipper, will give us a shout any time now about going in. Light enough to see a line being tossed. Sure enough, within the next few minutes, the tug's master radioed the rescue craft. I'm going to risk tossing a streamer to the ship. Same drill. The master speaks good English. Over? Yep, I'll take up position at 2 o'clock off the Mixim's bow, ready for MOB. It's still pretty dodgy even though the big ones are abating. He's managing some semblance of navigation without the rudder, using his side thrusters. I'll follow your moves. Over? The two smaller vessels took a little time to position themselves. Instructions proceeded between tug, wheelhouse and coaster. A couple of seamen appeared on deck, and picking what handholds offered greater security, played a game of cat and mouse with the pitch and roll of the ship. Reaching the bow, they waited for the ball and line from the tug. Tug and coaster were lined up with wind direction as best as conditions allowed. One of Robin's crew was positioned astern, attached to a safety line, swinging the ball ready to increase its momentum for a throw. An opportunity presented itself as coaster sank into a trough and tug rose simultaneously on a high swell. The ball arched well above spray and decks of both vessels, but a gust took it sideways back into the drink. That looks like Mick Trelaw tossing the line. He's the only bugger with a swing strong enough to span the gap. Look, I'm going to pull in closer to the ship. Those two don't look happy up there. Radio Robin and the coaster. Tell them we're positioning off her port anchor. You still okay about the wheel, Andy? Bill swiveled in his chair and faced the crewman he'd handed control to earlier. Yep, all set. Right, as soon as Dave gets acknowledgement, take her in. The replies came within seconds. Bill watched Andrew Cornwell and did a quick take on his stance and facial expression. Satisfied there was no hint of indecision, he focused on the bow and the two seamen fighting the lunge of the deck with each wave surge. They alternated handholds with whatever protruding piece of steel provided a grip. One of them wasn't quick enough transferring to a second grip. A pitch to starboard swung him back, loosening his one hold on a piece of piping. His back thumped into the case of the hydraulic motor that operated the anchor winding gear. Winded, he let go of the piping. At the same time, the bow dipped as a rogue wave swept across its deck. The rescue crew watched, knowing what was going to happen next. The stunned crewman was like a rag doll, limp, limbs uncoordinated. It was probably this which saved him from fracturing bones, since rigid resistance is the most likely cause of damage in a fall. But this did not save him from the cascade that washed him up over the ship's gunwale and down into the swirl below. Andy Cornwell didn't need direction from Bill Hawken. He accelerated into the gap between tug and coaster. Two crew members left the safety of the wheelhouse and shackled themselves, one to the port, the other to the starboard exterior guide rails. Ready to lunge forward for a grip on the ditched seaman, a white face bobbed up and down in the water, a few meters off the hull of the coaster. "I'm leaving this entirely up to you, Andy. Don't hesitate to trust yourself." "Okay, Bill." Andrew took the boat as close as he dared to the ship's grey plates. "Bloody hell, he's getting close to the side thruster." Andrew voiced his comment, at the same time swinging the dark blue hull of the Tamar through a 90-degree turn, heading between victim and impeller. Bill had already noticed the warning image of a thruster stenciled above the location of its duct. The two men out on deck had spotted it too, and were prepared for Andy Cornwell's maneuver. They were now positioned down at the sunken level of the side decks, ready to grab and haul. "Hell, he's gone down again." The white face, in spite of a buoyancy aid, had disappeared beneath the surface, just as the Tamar's bow was within a couple of meters to the left of the dazed seaman. There can't be enough suction this far out from the hull to pull him into the mincer if it's on reverse thrust. He's got a surface. Andy was talking to himself, half in hope and half to the rest of the mob in the wheelhouse. Bill stared through a cockpit window and did not reply. Anything could happen. The sea did not oblige the hopeful, but he was a pragmatist and believer in a man's survival instinct. Sure enough, the seaman reappeared, but he was too close to the coaster's hull. If the lifeboat moved in, he risked being crushed between the two craft. Mike Traherne was at the starboard side. The only course open was to toss a line to the now alert seaman. Mike could see the man was losing energy, partly through the cold, and partly fighting to keep his head above the constant buffering of the choppy sea. Like the tug line, the first attempt failed. Mike pulled in the rope and waited. The Tamar rose a meter or so above the trough, in which the struggling seaman was treading water. This was the best chance for a second throw. Any longer and the victim risked being sucked into the waterline. The rope uncoiled through the spray and landed across one shoulder of its target. The seaman had enough energy to loop it below one shoulder and armpit. Mike tested the line. The man moved a few inches towards him, managing to signal with an arm up. That was enough for Mike. He hauled in the line at speed, ready to slacken off if the need demanded. His quarry reached the blue hull, but was washed a meter or two towards the stern by a wave. The danger now was the starboard bilge keel forming the open propeller duct of the rescue craft. The risk was small, but nonetheless still a risk, that his foot could be pulled into the propeller. Andrew Cornwell needed to maintain a thrust of sorts and didn't throttle down too low. Mike Traherne hauled back on the line as the subsiding wave gave him some respite. He was a strong man, but his arms were beginning to tire from the effort of managing the rope. The seaman got a surge of energy as he again neared the lowered gunwale of the boat. He kicked out and made a frantic single breaststroke towards the safety of the Tamar. Mike let go the line, took a firm hold of the nearest rail post, and reached out over the water. His gloved hand managed to grip a strap of the flotation aid on the back of the gasping seaman. He pulled the man across the rim of the boat, his legs now almost clear of the water. This was the hardest part when the full weight was no longer assisted by the water's buoyancy. Mercifully, the boat rolled back down into another trough, and added buoyancy enabled Mike to slide the man wholly onto the side deck. He hurriedly tied a makeshift loop around the shoulders of the gasping seaman, then fixed the slack line more securely to the boat's superstructure. Mike then made ready to instruct his charge as soon as the man had got his wits back and he could check for body injury. His fellow crewman had by this time arrived to give assistance. Satisfied there were no fractures to main limbs, they managed to get him on his feet and took advantage of each counter surge to bring him into the relative safety of the rear deck. Dick Truman, an A&E doctor at the local hospital and also crew member, was waiting in the aft area, ready to examine the exhausted seaman. The three crewmen got him out of his storm gear, such as it was. The medic confirmed there were no breaks, but would need to check for internal damage. There was no blood being coughed up. That the seaman was gasping was an indication no ribs were broken. The pain from a broken ribcage would have prevented normal lung function. After a series of what Dick termed field tests, he pronounced the rescued seaman fit enough for the journey back, without the need for an airlift to Truro Hospital by the standby Sea King. Back on the coaster, a third seaman was already in the bow, ready to assist the remaining crewman to catch the tow. The thrower on the tug had by this time got the feel of wind gusts and the rhythm of the surges on the soles of his deck boots. He waited as coaster dipped and tug rose and released ball and leader in a smooth underarm throw. The missile performed the classic trajectory of a parabola, arching above spray in a period of gust-free winds to land across the anchor-winding capstan. The two on the coaster made a secure hitch of the trace of the safety rail surrounding the winder before hauling in the heavy tow rope from the tug. This they did at each fall of the bow, resting as the coaster tilted back up again. Apart from the possibility of a tow line parting, the next risk would be the tow post it was attached to. If it had been merely welded like a stub to the deck top plate, rather than a post sunk into the hull and securely fixed to the deck below, there was a danger the stub would be ripped from rusted, flimsy welds, or worse, pull the plate from the deck, leaving a gaping hole for water to flood into. Fortunately, apart from other glaring omissions in its architecture, a weak tow post was not part of the ship's structure. The tow cable was secured, and both men retreated to the safety of the coaster's interior. With sea conditions a picnic to the earlier sup with Satan, the trio set off to port. Bill Hawken put the rescue craft to the land side of tug and coaster. They made good passage. With a sou'westerly wind assisting them and waves no longer mountainous, the journey time back wasn't a lot longer than the outward pull, even with the dragging mass of the coaster. Bill Hawken and his mob accompanied the two vessels to the foul estuary with no further scurs, and with task completed, headed into the calm of the marina to tie up and shed their gear in the warmth of the lifeboat station. "I'll do a quick check of the mission data," Bill addressed the crew, now freed from their survival kit, "and write up a brief set of notes before going home. The rest of you, great effort. Thanks again. Get back to the families. See you here Friday." Bill assessed the SIMS, Systems and Information Management System, to check that a full log of the mission had been automatically recorded. Handling the Tamar-class boats was a much easier game than those he'd crewed in the past. The single system was clear in the way it presented information. Through an intuitive control console design and boat systems management, it had done away with a multiplicity of separate standalone systems that made for a tiring and dangerous exchange of movement in the tight wheelhouse. He had known crew members to break an arm or suffer other injury while swapping operational roles in a pitching and rolling vessel. Satisfied that the information of the last few hours had been fully logged, he went to the small office overlooking the marina and called his wife. Pulling the office laptop out of hibernation mode, he assessed a template that allowed him to type in quickly other details of the shout. A final comment section gave him cause for reflection. He wrote simply, "We set out with two propellers and came back with three."